A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking us to walk through the entire construction process for a 30-story high-rise, stage by stage, from digging the hole all the way to topping out, with a focus on two things, how long each phase takes, and what it sounds like if you're living next door. The real question at the heart of this is whether we can build the dense housing cities desperately need without making life unbearable for the people already there. So, can a 30-story tower go up without torturing the neighborhood?
The short answer is no, not entirely. But the longer answer, and this is what we're going to spend the episode on, is that most of the misery is concentrated in specific phases, and there are actual proven ways to take the edge off. What I want to do is walk through this chronologically, like we're standing at the site fence watching it happen.
A construction calendar, week by week, noise by noise.
So let's set the baseline first. A 30-story residential tower, from the day they fence off the site to the day they hand over the keys, typically takes 18 to 30 months. The spread depends on foundation complexity, weather windows, and how much prefabrication is happening. But somewhere around 2 years is normal. And before we get into the noise numbers, we need a quick framework for what those numbers mean. Construction noise is measured in dBA, A-weighted decibels, which adjusts for how the human ear actually perceives sound at different frequencies. The key distinction is between continuous noise, like a generator humming all day, and impact noise, like a pile driver slamming every few seconds. Impact noise is almost always what generates complaints, even when the measured dBA is similar to continuous noise, because the sudden spike is what our brains find jarring.
It's not just the volume, it's the shape of the sound.
The shape of the sound. And most city noise bylaws recognize this. They'll have different limits for continuous versus impulsive noise. A typical urban construction noise limit is around 85 dBA at the property line during daytime hours, but for impact noise it might be lower or restricted to specific hours. Tokyo, for instance, has some of the strictest rules globally. Pile driving is banned within 50 meters of hospitals and schools, period, and all major sites have to post real-time noise readings on public displays.
Which feels like the kind of thing that should be standard everywhere but somehow isn't.
We'll get to that. So let's start the clock. The hoarding goes up, the site is fenced, and if there is an existing building on the lot, demolition happens first. Hydraulic breakers mounted on excavators, basically giant jackhammers, are hitting 85 to 95 dBA at 50 feet. That's roughly equivalent to a heavy truck passing at close range, except it's not passing, it's staying.
The musical equivalent of a headache that learned to operate heavy machinery.
Demolition might take 2 to 4 weeks depending on what's there. But the real noise hasn't even started yet. After the site is cleared, we move into shoring and underpinning, stabilizing the perimeter so the hole doesn't collapse. This is soldier piles and lagging, or secant pile walls if they're going deep. Drilling rigs are running at 80 to 90 dBA continuous. It's a low-frequency rumble that you feel as much as you hear.
This is all at street level, radiating horizontally straight into neighboring buildings.
That's the crucial point. For the first 3 or 4 months, all the noise sources are at grade. There's no building structure to block or absorb anything. The sound just blasts outward. This is why the early phases generate the most complaints. A 2023 study from the University of Sydney measured noise at 12 high-rise construction sites and found that pile driving accounted for 70% of all noise complaints despite being only 5% of the total construction duration.
5% of the time, 70% of the fury.
Here's why. Impact pile driving, literally a massive weight dropped onto a steel pile to drive it into the ground, produces 105 to 115 dBA at 50 feet. That's chainsaw at close range territory. But it's worse than a chainsaw because it's percussive. Each impact sends a shockwave through the ground. Your windows rattle. Your coffee cup vibrates across the table. The airborne noise might technically be within legal limits, but the groundborne vibration is what makes people feel like they're living inside a drum.
What determines whether a project uses impact piles versus something quieter?
Soil conditions, mostly. If you're building on soft soil or fill, impact driving might be the only way to get the piles to the required depth and load-bearing capacity. But if the geotechnical survey says the ground can handle it, you can use auger cast piles instead, basically drilling a hole, filling it with concrete, and dropping the reinforcement in. That's 75 to 85 dBA instead of 115, so roughly 20 to 30 decibels quieter. The trade-off is that auger cast piles produce more vibration during the drilling phase, and they're not suitable for every soil type. There's also vibratory piling, which uses a vibrating hammer to shake the pile into the ground. It's about 20 decibels quieter than impact driving, but it takes longer.
You're trading time for peace. 3 extra weeks of moderate noise instead of 2 weeks of extreme noise.
That's exactly the trade-off, and we have a real case study for this. The Salesforce Tower in San Francisco, a 61-story tower, completed a few years back, specified vibratory piling for the foundation instead of impact. It reduced noise by 20 dBA, which is a perceived reduction of about 75% to the human ear, but it added 3 weeks to the foundation schedule. For a project of that scale, 3 weeks is real money. But they were building in a dense downtown with residential buildings directly adjacent, and the alternative would have been a public relations disaster and likely work stoppages.
The quiet option, as insurance against angry neighbors with lawyers.
Now, once shoring is done, we hit bulk excavation, weeks 4 through 8, roughly. This is 4 to 6 weeks of excavators and dump trucks removing soil for a typical 3 or 4 level basement. Noise here is 75 to 85 dBA, which isn't as intense as pile driving, but it's relentless. You've got excavators digging, trucks idling, trucks accelerating away all day. The continuous nature of it wears people down in a different way. It's not the sharp spike of a pile driver, it's the drone of a construction site that never stops.
The acoustic equivalent of being slowly sanded down.
Then we get to one of the most intense single events in the entire project, the mat slab pour. This is weeks 8 to 14 roughly. The mat slab is the thick concrete foundation that the entire building sits on. For a 30-story tower, we're talking about a slab that might be 4 to 6 feet thick, and it requires an enormous volume of concrete. We're talking 500 to 800 truckloads over 24 to 48 hours of continuous pouring.
You've got a convoy of concrete mixers arriving every few minutes for 2 straight days.
And each truck is generating about 85 to 90 dBA as it maneuvers and discharges. The concrete pump running at ground level is another 80 dBA of continuous noise. This pour cannot stop once it starts because you get cold joints in the concrete, which compromise structural integrity. So it runs through the night. Many cities require special permits for overnight concrete pours, and the smart contractors will notify neighbors weeks in advance, but it's still a miserable 48 hours if you're next door.
Then, after all that silence?
The concrete needs 7 to 14 days to cure, and during that period the site goes quiet. Maybe occasional inspection visits, maybe someone spraying curing compound, but it's the calm after the storm. Which is a good moment to note something. The noise profile of construction is not a steady drone. It's a series of intense spikes followed by lulls. Understanding that pattern is useful if you're a neighbor trying to plan around it.
We've dug the hole and poured the foundation. Now the building actually starts going up. How does the noise change?
This is where one of the biggest misconceptions gets busted. Most people assume the loudest part is when they're building the upper floors. You see the crane swinging, you hear the banging, it's visible. But the reality is that once the building starts rising, the structure itself begins to act as a noise barrier. Sound from upper floors doesn't radiate horizontally the way ground level sound does. It disperses into open air, and by the time it reaches street level, it's significantly attenuated.
The building shields its own noise.
Not completely, but noticeably. The superstructure phase, weeks 14 through 60, is where the building grows. You're looking at roughly a floor per week for a typical 30-story tower, sometimes faster if they're using jump forms for the concrete core. The core is the building's spine. It contains the elevators, stairs, and mechanical risers. They use a jump form or slip form system, which is basically a self-climbing mold that they pour concrete into, let it set, then jack it up to the next level. The noise from this is repetitive impact, Formwork being struck, hammers knocking forms into place, and it hits 90 to 100 dBA at the source.
90 to 100 dBA? But now it's 60 feet up, then 100 feet up, then 200 feet up.
The height changes everything. Sound intensity drops by about 6 decibels every time you double the distance from the source. So something hitting 95 dBA at the source might be 75 dBA at street level if the source is 100 feet up, compared to if it were at street level where you'd get the full 95 directly. The tower crane is another constant presence during this phase. That electric whine is about 70 to 80 dBA, and it's continuous during operating hours. But the crane motor is usually at the top of the tower, so again, height helps. What doesn't help is rebar work. Cutting and tying rebar produces 85 to 95 dBA of intermittent noise, and on the lower floors, that still reaches the street.
What about concrete pumping for the floor slabs? I'd imagine having a pump at ground level running all day is noticeable.
The concrete pump itself is about 80 to 85 dBA, and since it's at street level, that noise radiates directly into the neighborhood. You've got the pump engine running, the boom swinging overhead, and the concrete being placed. It's not the loudest activity on site, but it's one of the most persistent during the superstructure phase because every floor needs concrete. And for a 30-story building, you're doing this roughly 30 times.
A monthly reminder that you live next to a construction site.
More frequent than monthly. If they're doing a floor a week, that's a concrete pour every week. Usually it's a single day per floor, but it's a long day. So the rhythm of the superstructure phase is quiet days for formwork and rebar, then a noisy day for the pour, then repeat, for 40 to 50 weeks.
That covers the bones of the building. But a high-rise isn't just concrete and steel. What about everything that goes inside?
This is where the timeline gets interesting because several phases overlap. While the upper floors are still being framed, the lower floors are already getting their mechanical, electrical, and plumbing rough-in. We're talking weeks 30 through 70. MEP rough-in involves core drilling through concrete floors to run pipes and ducts, diamond core drills hitting 90 to 100 dBA. Ductwork installation means sheet metal being cut and riveted, which is 85 to 95 dBA of intermittent screeching. And all of this is supported by generators and air compressors running continuously at 75 to 85 dBA.
Even as the structural noise starts to fade because the source is higher up, you've now got a new layer of noise from the lower floors.
Here's the thing about MEP noise. It's inside the building, but the building doesn't have its facade yet, or it only partially does, so a lot of that sound still escapes through the open sides. The facade and glazing phase runs from roughly week 40 to week 80. Curtain wall panels, big aluminum and glass units, are lifted by the crane and bolted into place. Impact wrenches are hitting 85 to 95 dBA.
The thing that makes noise is also the thing that stops noise.
Construction in a nutshell. Now, once the facade is substantially complete, say the building is fully enclosed, the interior finishing phase kicks in for real. Weeks 60 through 100. This is drywall, painting, flooring. Sanders, nail guns, vacuums. 70 to 85 dBA, but it's largely contained within the building envelope. The neighbors might hear a distant hum or the occasional thump, but it's not the same category of disruption as the early phases. One exception, elevator installation. Welding and grinding in the elevator shaft produces 90 to 100 dBA, and the shaft acts like a chimney for sound. It can carry noise all the way up and out the top. But it's intermittent, and it's inside.
Then the final phase, landscaping, site restoration, inspections. Weeks 90 through 110. I'm guessing this is the quietest part.
65 to 75 dBA from landscaping equipment. Lawnmowers, compactors for paving, maybe a small excavator for planting trees. At this point, it's basically normal urban background noise. The building is done, the hoarding comes down, and the site becomes, the whole process, from first fence to final handover, has been roughly 2 years, and the noisiest period was the first 3 to 4 months.
Which is counterintuitive. The building is tallest at the end, so you'd think the end is loudest. But it's exactly the opposite. The whole is louder than the tower.
Because noise at ground level has nowhere to go but sideways. Once the structure is up, the noise sources are elevated and partially shielded. It's a lesson in acoustic physics that most people learn the hard way, by living through it.
Let's talk about what actually works for reducing this. You mentioned vibratory piling and auger cast piles. What else is in the mitigation toolkit?
There's a whole hierarchy of controls. The most effective is substitution, replacing a noisy method with a quieter one. Silent piling rigs, also called press-in piling, use hydraulic force to push piles into the ground instead of hammering them. They can reduce impact noise from 110 dBA down to about 85 dBA. The catch is, they're slower and more expensive, and they don't work in all soil conditions. But where they do work, they're transformative.
Then there's enclosing the noise at the source.
Right, engineering controls. Acoustic blankets draped over shoring walls can reduce noise by 5 to 10 dBA. That doesn't sound like much, but remember, a 10 dBA reduction is perceived as roughly half as loud to the human ear. You can also get fully enclosed pile-driving rigs with sound-absorbing panels. Some contractors build temporary acoustic sheds around stationary equipment like generators and compressors. These are cheap and effective. Plywood lined with mineral wool insulation can knock 15 dBA off a generator's noise signature.
Like building a little house for your noise machine.
Then there are administrative controls, scheduling restrictions. Most cities already restrict construction to weekday daytime hours, typically 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. or similar. But some jurisdictions are going further. Parts of Vancouver and several European cities now require a quiet period from noon to 2 p.m. No impact noise during lunch. It sounds minor, but for someone working from home or caring for an infant, that two-hour window is everything.
The most modern approach, real-time monitoring.
This is where it gets interesting. Systems from companies like Bruhl and Kiar allow contractors to place noise monitors around the site perimeter that feed data to a web dashboard in real time. If noise at a specific monitor exceeds a threshold, the site manager gets an alert and can adjust operations, move the noisy activity to the other side of the site, add temporary barriers, or just pause until conditions improve. Tokyo mandates public-facing noise displays at major sites. Anyone walking past can see the current dBA reading. It creates accountability without requiring enforcement inspections.
Transparency is a regulatory tool. Show the numbers, let the public see them, and the site behaves because everyone's watching.
A 2022 study by the UK's Institute of Acoustics found that proactive notification of noisy activities, just telling neighbors what's coming and when, reduces complaints by 50%. That's not even a technology solution. That's just communication. Send a letter, put up a sign, post on a neighborhood group. People are much more tolerant of disruption when they know it's coming and they know when it will end.
The psychology of noise. A known disruption is half as annoying as a surprise one.
There's actual research backing that up. If you know the pile driving will be Tuesday through Thursday 9 to 5, you can plan around it. If it's random, you feel under siege.
We've painted a pretty noisy picture. But here's the central question from the prompt. Can we actually build a 30-story tower without making neighbors miserable? Is that a realistic goal, or are we just talking about degrees of misery?
I think it's realistic to say we can build without making neighbors acutely miserable. Chronic low-grade annoyance might be unavoidable. But the kind of misery that drives people to move out, to file lawsuits, to show up at city council meetings, that's concentrated in the first 3 to 4 months, and it's concentrated in specific activities like pile driving and the mat slab pour. If you address those aggressively, silent piling, acoustic enclosures, strict scheduling, proactive communication, you can take the worst edges off. You're not making it pleasant, but you're making it survivable.
The cost of those mitigations?
That's the tension. Silent piling might add 2 to 3 weeks to the foundation schedule and increase cost by somewhere in the range of 5 to 15% for that phase of work. Acoustic monitoring systems are cheap, maybe a few $1,000s for the duration of the project. Acoustic blankets and equipment enclosures are also relatively inexpensive. The real cost is time. Every week of extended foundation work is a week of carrying costs on the land, a week of delayed revenue. For a 30-story residential tower, the carrying costs can be substantial.
The developer's incentive is to go fast, and going fast means going loud.
Unless the regulatory environment changes the incentive. If the city says impact pile driving is banned within 100 meters of residences, then the cost calculation shifts. Going loud is no longer an option, so you budget for the quieter method from day one. That's what Tokyo did, and the construction industry adapted. It didn't stop building, it just changed how it builds.
The market adapts to the rules. If the rules don't require quiet, quiet doesn't happen.
Sometimes it does. If the developer is building luxury condos and the neighbors are potential buyers, there's a market incentive to be a good neighbor. But for rental buildings or office towers, the developer might never interact with the neighbors at all. That's where regulation matters.
Let's do a quick tour of how different cities handle this. You mentioned Tokyo. What about other places?
Tokyo is the gold standard. Real-time public noise displays, silent piling mandates near sensitive receptors, and a cultural norm of extreme consideration for neighbors. Construction sites in Tokyo often have full-height acoustic barriers, essentially temporary walls around the entire site that can reduce noise by 15 to 20 dBA. These are expensive, but they're standard practice for major projects.
What about somewhere like New York?
New York has a detailed noise code with specific decibel limits for different types of equipment and different times of day. But enforcement is complaint-driven. If nobody complains, nothing happens. And in a city where construction is constant background noise, the complaint threshold is high. The city did adopt a quieter pile-driving method for some public projects after a pilot program in the mid-2010s, but it's not universal.
A tale of two approaches, mandated quiet versus complaint-driven enforcement.
The results track the approach. Tokyo's construction sites are noticeably quieter than New York's, despite building at similar density. The difference is regulatory will.
What about London?
London has the Considerate Constructor Scheme, which is a voluntary code of practice that scores construction sites on noise, dust, and community engagement. Sites that score well get to display a CCS banner, and many major clients, including the public sector, require CCS registration. It's not legally binding, but it has created a reputational incentive to be quieter. Noise limits are set by individual boroughs, so it's a patchwork, but the overall trend is towards stricter monitoring.
Voluntary but with teeth, because reputation matters when you're bidding for the next project.
It's a different lever, but it pulls in the same direction.
Let's distill this into something practical. If I'm a resident and I find out a 30-story tower is going up next door, what should I actually do?
First, understand the timeline. The worst noise will be in the first 3 to 4 months. That's your window for planning. If you can arrange a temporary relocation during the pile driving and excavation phase, even just staying with family or friends during the day, that's the single biggest quality of life improvement you can make. If relocation isn't possible, invest in good noise-canceling headphones, the over-ear kind with active noise cancellation. They're not perfect for impact noise, but they take the edge off continuous noise significantly.
If you're a renter, this is also the moment to negotiate.
A 30-story construction project next door is a material change to your living situation. In many jurisdictions, that's grounds for a rent reduction. Document the noise levels. There are free smartphone apps that measure decibels reasonably accurately. Take readings at different times of day. Present them to your landlord or property manager. You may not get a reduction, but you have a much stronger case with data than with complaints.
What about for developers and architects? If you're writing the tender documents for a project, what should you be specifying?
First, require a pre-construction noise and vibration assessment, a proper one, not a boilerplate paragraph. This should model noise propagation to all adjacent buildings and identify the specific activities that will exceed local limits. Second, specify silent or low noise piling methods wherever geotechnically feasible. Write it into the contract, don't leave it as a suggestion. Third, mandate real-time noise monitoring with public-facing data. The monitoring equipment costs a few thousand dollars for the duration of the project. That's a rounding error on a 30-story tower budget, and it prevents disputes before they start. The single highest impact policy is to require real-time noise monitoring with public dashboards for any project over a certain size. Vancouver and Tokyo have shown this works. The second is to tighten the rules around pile driving specifically. Ban impact pile driving within a certain radius of residences, hospitals, and schools, and require the use of press-in or vibratory methods. The third is to close the enforcement gap. Most cities have noise bylaws, but enforcement is reactive and under-resourced. Fund proactive inspections or require third-party acoustic consultants to sign off on compliance.
The toolkit exists. The question is whether anyone uses it.
That's really the bottom line. A 30-story building cannot be built silently. The fundamental activities, breaking rock, pouring concrete, driving piles, are inherently loud. But the difference between a site that makes neighbors miserable and one that's merely annoying is not about finding some magical silent construction method. It's about whether the developer chooses, or is required, to use the quieter versions of those methods and to communicate with the people affected.
The quiet option is almost always available. It just costs more, or takes longer. And whether it gets used depends on whether someone, the developer, the regulator, the market, decides the quiet is worth paying for.
That's the question every city is answering right now, block by block, tower by tower. As urban infill accelerates, Toronto, London, Sydney, all building up because they can't build out, the conflict between density and livability is only getting sharper. Every new tower is a test case.
Where does this go in the future? You mentioned earlier that modular and prefabricated construction might change the noise equation.
This is the genuinely exciting part. The next frontier is what some people are calling silent construction. Instead of casting concrete and welding steel on site, you manufacture large building modules in a factory, complete rooms or even entire apartment units, and then truck them to the site and bolt them together. The on-site noise drops dramatically because you're assembling, not fabricating. No rebar cutting, no formwork hammering, no concrete pumping, just a crane lifting modules and crews bolting connections.
How much of a noise reduction are we talking about?
Estimates suggest on-site noise could drop by up to 60% compared to traditional construction. The noisy activities, cutting, welding, pouring, move to the factory, which is typically in an industrial zone where noise isn't an issue. On-site, you've got crane operation, bolt tightening, and finishing work. It's not silent, but it's a fundamentally different acoustic profile.
We're seeing this actually happen.
It's still early, but yes. There are modular high-rises going up in London, Singapore, and a few in New York. The tallest modular hotel in the world, a 26-story tower in New York, went up a few years ago. The construction time was cut by about 30%, and neighbor complaints were dramatically lower than for comparable traditional projects. The limitation right now is that modular construction works best for highly repetitive layouts. Hotels, student housing, some residential. It's less suited to buildings with complex geometries or mixed uses on different floors.
The future of quiet construction might also be the future of boring architecture.
Not necessarily boring, but certainly more repetitive. Though I'd argue that the difference between an interesting facade and a boring one doesn't have to be structural. You can do a lot with cladding, but that's a different episode.
Before we wrap, let's hit the misconceptions you flagged earlier. The big one, that the upper floors are the loudest part.
We've covered that. It's actually the excavation and foundation, because the noise is at ground level with no shielding. The second misconception, that modern construction is dramatically quieter than it used to be. The reality is that the fundamental activities haven't changed much. We still drill, hammer, and pour. What's changed is regulation and mitigation. The blankets, the enclosures, the scheduling. The inherent loudness of construction is roughly what it was 50 years ago. We've just gotten better at managing it.
The third, that noise complaints are just about volume.
Vibration and low-frequency noise are often the real culprits. Pile driving and excavation generate ground-borne vibration that travels into adjacent buildings and causes rattling, even when the airborne noise is within legal limits. Low-frequency noise, the rumble of generators, the throb of concrete pumps, is particularly annoying because it penetrates walls more easily than high frequencies. Standard DBA measurements actually underweight low frequencies, so a site can be in compliance on paper while still driving neighbors up the wall.
Which is why that University of Sydney study finding is so telling. 70% of complaints from 5% of the activity. Pile driving isn't the loudest thing on site in terms of continuous DBA, but it's the most intrusive because of the combination of impact, vibration, and unpredictability.
It's the shape of the sound, as you said. Our brains are wired to notice sudden loud transients. It's an alert system, a constant hum we can eventually tune out. A pile driver every 3 seconds? You can't tune that out. It hijacks your attention every single time.
To land this, if you're living next to a future high-rise, the first 3 to 4 months are the gauntlet. Plan around them. If you're building one, specify the quiet methods from day one. Retrofitting mitigation after complaints roll in is more expensive than doing it right from the start. And if you're regulating one, real-time monitoring and public transparency are the cheapest, most effective tools in the box.
The broader picture, density is coming. Cities need housing. The choice isn't between building and not building. The choice is between building loudly and building thoughtfully. The technology exists. The methods exist. The question is whether we demand them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, Greenland sheep farmers cultivated a heritage grain called Greenlandic black barley, a short-season variety adapted to subarctic summers. By 1938, the total cultivated area for this barley across all of Greenland was just under 4 acres.
A global agricultural empire. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the fact and the faders. If you found this useful, please rate and review the show. It helps other curious minds find us. We're back soon with more.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.